We've come to the third chapter in the letter of James. I'm going to read from the first verse to put us in context. My brethren, let not many of you become teachers, knowing that we shall receive a stricter judgment. For we all stumble in many things. If anyone does not stumble in word, he is a perfect man, able also to bridle the whole body. Indeed, we put bits in horses' mouths that they may obey us, and we turn their whole body. Look also at ships. Although they are so large and are driven by fierce winds, they are turned by a very small rudder, wherever the pilot desires. Even so, the tongue is a little member, and boasts great things. See how great a forest a little fire kindles. And the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. The tongue is so set among our members that it defiles the whole body and sets on fire the course of nature, and it is set on fire by hell. For every kind of beast and bird, of reptile and creature of the sea, is tamed and has been tamed by mankind. But no man can tame the tongue. It is an unruly evil, full of deadly poison. Maybe pause there for a while and look at what is being said here. James Yaakov, his real name is Yaakov, he's writing, and rather than leveling point-blank accusations, he proceeds by supposition. Suppose that this is true. What do you think of it? That kind of thing. Putting it to us, proposing the case to us. And here he says, see what damage the tongue can do. But he's already given us the clue in verse 1, that there are lots of people who are wise in their own eyes and who consider that they are fitted to teach, that they really are qualified to lord it over others and to tell others what they are to do, what they are to believe, and so on. Many lives have been ruined by these self-appointed prophets who have told people that God says you should do this or you should be that, and they've ruined people's lives. I know of one or two cases myself. And it all comes from the tongue. He says at the end of verse 5, see how great a forest a little fire kindles. We see these warning signs, especially in the summer, about throwing cigarettes, lighted cigarettes out of the window when driving through the forest, or not putting out your campfire, even a spark. We get these instructions in our campsites. Soak your fire with water and stir the ashes to make sure that no spark remains. That's the kind of care we have to take in order to keep BC green, or to keep Canada green for that matter. Just a little spark can cause a terrible forest fire, and hundreds of hectares or thousands can get burned up. See and how long it takes to revive that burned out forest. In Israel too, we've had forest fires on Mount Carmel, near Jerusalem too, and other places. So we see a little spark. That's the hymn, as a popular hymn. It only takes a spark to get a fire going. In this case, it's an unfavorable connotation. The tongue is like that little spark. That's what the writer is saying. And that little spark can cause so much harm, so much damage. In verse 6, he says, The tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. The tongue is so set among our members that it defiles the whole body and sets on fire the course of nature, and it is set on fire by hell. It is as full of sin as would fill the world. The whole man is tainted with sin through the misuse of the tongue. In one of the Psalms, Asaph, the writer, speaks about those whose tongue walks through the earth. And Daniel the prophet speaks about the Antichrist, that he's a mouth speaking great things. Just look back at our history and we'll find that many of the worst conflicts the world has seen have been the result of some big talker, some big mouth. So we find here it's a very salutary warning to avoid this snare. Let me take you back to Kohelet, Ecclesiastes, chapter 5. In Ecclesiastes, chapter 5, we find Solomon himself. He says the same thing. Verse 6. Really, the first five verses as well, but we look at verse 6. Do not let your mouth cause your flesh to sin, nor say before the messenger of God that it was an error. Why should God be angry at your excuse and destroy the work of your hands? The warning here is that if we talk out of turn, we displease God. And it's no use saying, oh, it was a slip of the tongue. What God does when he is displeased for our intemperate speech is to penalize us. Moses, our great lawgiver, he also experienced the same thing. We read, our people provoked his spirit so that he spoke unadvisedly with his lips. And the consequence of that was he was excluded from the promised land. God said, you shall not take the people into the land. You shall die on this side of the Jordan. Moses pleaded with God. You find in Deuteronomy his inkwell was an inkwell of tears. As he wrote again and again to his people, I must die in this land. I cannot go over. I besought the Lord and he said, speak to me no more about this matter. What was it Moses said? The people wanted water. God said to him, take this rod and take the elders of Israel and go to the rock and speak to it. After 40 years, you'd have thought that Moses would have known how to obey a simple command. It was the very simplicity of the command that made his disobedience more culpable, more guilty, that made him more guilty. Hear now, you rebels! Must we fetch water for you out of this rock? And God said, you did not believe me to sanctify me before the children of Israel. God is merciful. We find that Yeshua at his transfiguration was seen by the disciples talking to Moshe. So he did get there, but not before he died. We see Moses could not gain any reprieve for that slip of the tongue. And it's a warning to us. I can sympathize wholeheartedly with Moshe. 2 million grumblers for 40 years and he only slipped up once. I would have failed in the first year. So we see how dangerous it is to speak out of turn. Here's another from the Brit HaChadasha. Evil communications corrupt good manners. What you say affects your life. That's really what it means. What you say will eventually influence your behavior. Therefore, the tongue needs to be very carefully controlled. An evil tongue sets the whole society on fire. In Proverbs chapter 26, Solomon again, he has much to say in the book of Proverbs and in the book of Ecclesiastes about wrong speech, evil speech. Proverbs 26, verse 18 and 19. Like a madman who throws firebrands, arrows, and death is the man who deceives his neighbor and says, I was only joking. That's why we are warned, avoid foolish jesting. Joking that can lend, that can cause a lot of trouble. An evil tongue sets society on fire. Their words, the words of the evil speaker, eat, says the Bible, eat up like a cancer. They are like a cancer. And furthermore, it not only defiles the whole body and sets on fire the course of nature, it is set on fire by hell. This is the evil source of such language. It comes from the evil one. In the book of Proverbs again in chapter 16 and verse 27, an ungodly man digs up evil, and it is on his lips like a burning fire. Do you notice that's not the only verse that speaks of it? Verse 28 also, a perverse man sows strife, and a whisperer separates the best of friends. Verse 29, a violent man entices his neighbor and leads him in a way that is not good. He winks his eye to devise perverse things. He purses his lips and brings about evil. Therefore, there's this warning. Why is Yaakov so insistent on this? It is because it is a common thing, a common failure. And therefore, it needs to be addressed. And because it is so harmful, it needs to be addressed in sharp tones. Verse 7, every kind of beast and bird, of reptile and creature in the sea is tamed and has been tamed by mankind. We were made in the image of God. God said, let us make man in our image and in our likeness. And we read in Genesis 1, verse 28, God blessed Adam and Eve, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. And although after the flood, although things were different after the flood, there's no longer such thing as sinlessness in this world. Still, there is this. When God says to Noah, the fear of you and the dread of you shall be on every beast of the earth and on every bird of the air, on all that move on the earth and on all the fish of the sea, they are given into your hand. Unfortunately, not completely, but to a large extent. So we find we are able to deal with animals, birds, and fishes. But he says, we can't deal with our own tongues. Verse 8, but no man can tame the tongue. It is an unruly evil, full of deadly poison. It is beyond man's control. Only God can control our tongues. We seek to do it, but we cannot do it by ourselves. David recognized this when he says in one of the Psalms, Psalm 141, this is how he prays, set a guard, O Lord, over my mouth. Keep watch over the door of my lips. How important it is. Count till 10 before you let that angry remark slip out. Hold it. I've said this before, And that proved it to be true in my experience. Even though you're right, if you can't say it in the right way, don't say anything. Keep it till later. You will be glad you did. God will give you the right opportunity to speak up. But even though you feel you have to vindicate yourself, if you can't do it in the right spirit, better not to say anything at all. You'll cause much less harm that way. Oh, says someone, but I must have my rights. Not at the expense of courtesy, not at the expense of grieving the Holy Spirit. No man can tame the tongue. It is an unruly evil. It needs a double rail. As one old writer put it, the lips and the teeth are like a double rail to keep in our tongues. And David himself, he says, I'm going to be very careful what I say. In Psalm 39, he says, I said, I will guard my ways, lest I sin with my tongue. I will restrain my mouth with a muzzle while the wicked are before me. I was mute with silence. I held my peace even from good, and my sorrow was stirred up. My heart was hot within me. While I was musing, the fire burned. Then I spoke with my tongue, Lord, make me to know my end, and what is the measure of my days, that I may know how frail I am. He was very careful not to speak out of turn. It is something that is full of evil. Back in the 140th Psalm, I'm shuttling through the Psalms with you because we find here the man of God speaking. We find that otherwise what we can say can be slanderous, venomous, hurtful, venomous remarks. In Psalm 140 in verse 3, he speaks about the evildoers. They sharpen their tongues like a serpent. The poison of asps is under their lips. Selah. That's what James means here when he says it is full of deadly poison. Evil speech hurts three people. It's hurtful to the one speaking evil. It is hurtful to the one who's being spoken against. And it's hurtful to those who listen, who overhear it. So three parties are already infected and hurt and wounded. And we know that what the Tanakh says about words, that they are the words of a talebearer, are like wounds. They go down into the deepest parts of the belly. We know what it is to remember some cruel comment made 20, 30 years ago. Maybe it was spoken rashly and the person has asked us forgiveness. We have given them our forgiveness. But you can't wipe out the memory of those cruel words. That should give us pause, then, to be very careful when we speak. This is another way he puts it in verse 9. With it, we bless our God and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in the similitude of God. God had to say to the wicked man, you sit and you speak, you slander your own mother's son, you speak against your own brother, and you think that I'm not going to take notice of it? God says, I kept silence when you did it. You thought that I was one like yourself, but I will rebuke you and set them in order before your eyes. Messiah said, every idle word that we speak, we shall have to give an account of in the day of judgment. Now all of us are saying in our hearts, God forgive me. I can remember the times when I said this. God does forgive. Let it be for us let us take this opportunity to pray that in our hearts that God will help us not to do the same thing again, not to repeat the mistake, not to compound the problem. He speaks about blessing God and cursing men. The Pharisee, when he was in the temple, he said, "God, I thank you that I'm not as other men are. Unjust, adulterers, extortioners, or even as this tax collector." He was there to bless God. He was, in a sense, cursing the tax collector. Why is it that the messianic movement died out? Why is it that the Jewish believers in the early centuries finally disappeared except for one or two here and there? It's because they were excluded from the synagogue by their unbelieving brothers and sisters. One of the things that made it impossible for our believing brothers and sisters to continue in the synagogue was an additional prayer to the Shmone Esrei. There was a prayer at that time in the days of the Second Temple called Shmone Esrei, the 18 benedictions. There was a 19th that was added. That made it impossible for Jewish believers to continue in the synagogue. I have a record of it here. A sample of it was found in the Cairo Geniza, so it was obvious. "For slanderers, let there be no hope, and let all wickedness perish in a moment. Let all thine enemies be speedily cut off, and the dominion of arrogance do thou uproot and crush, cast down and humble speedily in our days. Blessed art thou, O Lord, who breakest the enemies and humblest the arrows." In the Geniza, it's even more explicit. Geniza is a place in the synagogue where you store things. It's really a kind of a treasure house, treasure chamber. If any books were damaged or if the Torah scroll was damaged, they would put it aside in the Geniza. That's what they did in Cairo. And it was Rabbi Solomon Schechter, who found all these treasures. And this is the old text that was found for the Meshumadim, the renegades. That's Jewish believers. "Let there be no hope, and may the arrogant kingdom soon be rooted out in our days, and the Nazarenes," that's Christians, "and the Minim," that's Jewish believers, "perish as in a moment, and be blotted out from the book of life, and with the righteous may they not be inscribed. Blessed art thou, O Lord, who humblest the arrogant." Now that's what James means by blessing God with and cursing men. The same breath. This is the kind of thing that we can be guilty of and something we should avoid. "With it, with our tongue, we bless our God and Father, and with it we curse men who have been made in the similitude of God." Man is made in the image of God. What we say to them or to believers reflects on God. Someone will say, "Well, when man failed, the image of God was ruined." Yes, but even in the ruins of fallen man, you will find traces of the original image of God. When you and I go to other countries, what do we visit? We visit the ruins of the past. As the archaeologists seek to reconstruct the ruins of the past and show them, try and depict to us by drawings and diagrams what it must have been like before it was destroyed. So in all human beings we see traces of the original image of God. To a greater or lesser extent it is to be found. And therefore we respect those ruins. We respect our fellow men as human beings. It used to be, I don't know if it still is, but it used to be a capital offense, not capital, but a criminal offense in England to deface the coin of the realm. That meant if anybody defaced the coins in England, the pennies or the shillings, they were taken to court because the coins bore the image of Her Majesty the Queen or His Majesty the King. It was even an offense to put a stamp upside down on a letter, because that way contempt was being shown to the one whose image picture was on that stamp. So in the same way, we are to respect the image of God as far as we can see it in men. Remember what Yeshua said? When they said, should we give tribute to Caesar or not? He said, show me a penny. So they showed him a penny and he said, whose is this image? They said, Caesar's. He said, give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar. And give to God what belongs to God. He added that to their surprise. You and I have the image of God in us to a larger or lesser extent. We are to give ourselves to God because we are made in His image. That's what Messiah was seeking to teach the people. Proverbs chapter 17 and verse 5 says this: he who mocks the poor reproaches his maker. He who is glad at calamity will not go unpunished. We have to be very careful we don't look down our nose. And that's what Yaakov has been saying earlier on in chapter 2. He says, do not hold the faith of our Lord Yeshua HaMashiach, the Lord of glory, with partiality. The poor and the rich, we're to give them equal respect. We're to look beyond the outward clothing, the outward appearance, and say, here is a human being. Sometimes the policeman can be very unpopular, especially when he has to lay down the law. I heard of a case where he had pulled over a driver, and the driver was so obnoxious, the policeman took his hat off and he said, look at me, I am a person. And therefore, we have to remember that. Verse 10, coming back to Yaakov chapter 3, out of the same mouth proceed blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not so to be. It is incongruous, it is contradictory, like the Pharisee in his speech. We must do what is right, not what we feel like doing. Our practice must be governed by principles, and those principles must be squarely founded on the Word of God, this book that we have. We should get all our principles here of our behavior. So we are not to speak things we ought not. There are some who do it because they get gain by it. If they say the right thing, then they're likely to profit. Well, we're not to do things like that. Verse 11. Does a spring send forth fresh water and bitter from the same opening? It's an analogy from nature. In Jericho, in the time of Elisha the prophet, the people came to the prophet and they said, you see what a beautiful situation we're in, balmy weather and ideal location, it's warm in winter, it's green and fertile everywhere, but the ground is not producing, the water is polluted. So Elisha said, bring me a container of salt. They brought him a container of salt. He went to the source of the spring from which they get their water, and he threw the salt in at the source. And he says, thus says the Lord, these waters have been healed. The salt at the source. Salt speaks of preservative from corruption. It ought to be applied at the source of all our talk. And that's in effect what Solomon says again in the book of Proverbs, this time chapter 18. He says at length here, verse 4 through 8, he speaks about words. The words of a man's mouth are deep waters. The wellspring of wisdom is a flowing brook. It is not good to show partiality to the wicked or to overthrow the righteous in judgment. Speaking about passing sentence. A fool's lips enter into contention, and his mouth calls for blows. A fool's mouth is his destruction, and his lips are the snare of his soul. The words of a talebearer are like tasty trifles, and they go down into the inmost body. There we see a polluted fountain. It's either going to be pure or it's going to be polluted. Another analogy he puts in verse 12. Can a fig tree, my brethren, bear olives, or a grapevine bear figs? Thus no spring yields both salt water and fresh. Each reproduces after its kind. The Lord Yeshua said, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. So we need to pray with David that God will watch over what we say. No fountain here, he says, no spring yields both salt water and fresh. There is an oasis called Ein Gedi by the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea is full of salt water, so salt that practically nothing lives in it except some very microscopic plant life. Up on the hill at Ein Gedi, there's a freshwater spring gushing out its waters. So you have salt water from the Dead Sea, you have this fresh water gushing out over at the waterfall at the oasis of Ein Gedi. But they don't mix. It's either the one or the other. Unfortunately, as those waters tumble into the Dead Sea, they dilute the water of the Dead Sea, but they themselves become salty. Verse 13. Now we come to the positive. Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. The wise life and the wise lips go together. They are inseparable. A wise person is known not only by what he says, but by what he does. Wisdom, when she speaks in the book of Proverbs, she says, the sound speech is mine. That's wisdom personified. She says, I have sound speech. And she also says this, the pride and arrogance and the evil way and the perverse mouth I hate. Wisdom dislikes intensely anything that is perverse in speech. So we are told here, a wise man, an understanding, this is also with a glance at those who thought they were smart enough to boss it over the others. That's how we started the chapter, remember? His actions and behavior, though, the actions and behavior of a wise man are wisely ordered. His words and also his lifestyle. They match up with one another. Can't be anything but. In Ecclesiastes chapter 10, Ecclesiastes, he says, verse 11, a serpent may bite when it is not charmed. The babbler is no different. The words of a wise man's mouth are gracious, but the lips of a fool shall swallow him up. The words of his mouth begin with foolishness, and the end of his talk is raving madness. A fool also multiplies words, and so on. The warnings again and again. The Hebrew for word is davar. That's the Hebrew for thing or matter. Perhaps God wishes us to understand that words are concrete things. They can be weapons. They can cause a lot of good, they can cause a lot of harm. They are things, they're not just words. So we've got the challenge here. Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. Here's a Hebraism, meekness of wisdom. That means wise meekness, not put on, not something that is pretended, but something that is real meekness. The more true wisdom, the more meekness there is. Here's how an old writer put it. The laden clusters will bow the head. What he was saying is, if you've got a fruit tree, and one of those branches has lots of fruit on it, that branch bends. The sheer number of fruit causes the branch to bend, to bow. And so it is with the wise man. The more he has the true fruits of the Holy Spirit, the more he bows his head, the meeker he should be. Job had to remonstrate with his friends. They were telling him, Job, all your sufferings are because you've done something wrong. You've got to have done something wrong. Otherwise, all these things would never have happened to you. Come on, own up to it. Let's help you. And that's why they were called Job's comforters, because they accused him of things he had never done. Job answers them like this. Shall words of wind have an end? That's in Job 16. Or what provokes you that you answer? I also could speak as you do. If your soul were in my soul's place, I could heap up words against you and shake my head at you. But I would strengthen you with my mouth, and the comfort of my lips would relieve your grief. Job said, if I were in your shoes and you were in mine, I wouldn't do what you're doing to me. I wouldn't just be kicking a man when he's down. I would see what I could do to comfort, to soothe, to console, to encourage, to help, to lift up. And there's an example of what we mean here then. A wise and an understanding brother or sister is the one who realizes all our faults, but who doesn't harp on the negative, sees what they can do to be constructive, to edify, to build up. Need, N-E-E-D. I heard that N stands for necessary. In other words, if you're going to say something, is it necessary? Secondly, E, does it edify? The second E is, does it encourage? And D, need, necessary, edify. D probably means to dignify, that's it. Does it dignify? Is it necessary? Does it encourage? Does it edify? Does it dignify? Now we're to ask ourselves these things. Keep reminding ourselves of that word, need. A preacher in England mentions this thing. Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, do not boast and lie against the truth. Some of these people who wanted to be masters and teachers and boss it over the others, it is because of self-seeking, because they envied others. They wanted to be a cut above the rest. Here's what an old writer put, how he put it. Heat in good matters, that is, if you get warm and zealous in a good matter, but you have a selfish aim, he said, that heat is a coal not fetched from the altar, but from the kitchen. That's a telling statement. Heat in good matters out of a selfish aim is a coal not fetched from the altar, but from the kitchen. I thought that was great, great saying. So we are to avoid this thing, envying and strife, envying and self-seeking in your hearts. People may not see it. People may not realize it. They may say, oh, here's someone who's really zealous like Jehu. Come and see my zeal for the Lord. He was really only a self-seeker, as the subsequent events proved. Well, God willing, we'll continue next Shabbat to see what else he has to say, and how he mentions in verse 17, the wisdom that is from above is pure, peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy.